Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and noise to help you live a more positively minded life. Noise. Summer. Summer comes and you get a chance to hear all the different sounds out there. The birds are beautiful. Spring awakens and you hear all these beautiful voices. But of course you're going outdoors. And if you go to a swimming pool, you hear the babies, the children screaming in the pool, and they're screaming and they're just screaming at the top of their lungs. And if you're a little older, as you've gotten older, something happened to your ears that you're more sensitive to sound. So then you look and you say to people, tell your children to keep quiet. And you say, you say to your friends, some people just have no regard. Why could they have their children screaming like that? It's so disrespectful. And what we're not accounting for is a number of factors. Number one, there tends to be, in our society, a tendency for our ears to get a little more sensitive as we get older. According to a couple of our researchers, that seems to be damage to the ear mechanism. We're going to learn a little about that. There also is possible that, I believe, infants and babies are training themselves to be identifiable to their parents by learning to scream. Did you ever see penguins on an island when they're first born screaming, or seals screaming? That's how a mother identifies her babies when there are 10,000 babies. You could tell by the sound. Or in a herd of elk, the baby sound. That sound, that scream of each individual baby is known by the mother. So the babies in the pools are in effect saying, I'm in a dangerous place, I'm in water. If something happens to me, I want to be able to be discovered by my mother, so they develop their vocal cords. Interesting, isn't it? So now what we're watching is an evolutionary development of a child learning to scream and an older person who's got more sensitive ears, and we take it along and we make it a judgment. Judgments. How bad they are for screaming. Well, noise is such an amazing thing. Hearing is such an amazing thing that I thought we need to learn more about it. And who better to teach us about noise than George Prochnik? Prochnik, right? Yes. George, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
A beautiful book, In Pursuit of Silence, Not Meaning What You Think It Means. Sherry is with us, Sherry Siegel, and Lauren Sykes. On our usual day, Lauren. Good.
Hi.
Exciting to do the research, huh, today?
Yes.
All right, good. So here's what we're going to go into. I'm going to learn a lot. If I leave George alone to speak, he would teach us so much about sound and noise. I mean, you could tell, they can now tell by imaging the brain. You could see when one person talks where you have a response in certain parts of your brain that is identifiable. So if I had you on a functional MRI, a machine hooked up, and your wife called you, I don't have to hear her voice. But if you hear her voice, I can look at the imaging of your brain and I can tell you who's calling. That's remarkable, isn't it, Sherry?
It is. It's fascinating that fMRI has shown us so much. They were people.
Which is, by the way, remember, it's fMRI, which means not AM. fMRI.
Yes, go FM. But functional MRI looks at activity in the brain by looking at blood flow and metabolism. So it shows the activity in different areas of the brain. And what they did in that experiment that you're talking about is that they looked at three different groups of people. They made three different sounds. And the brain distinguished between different people saying different vowels. I mean, it's an amazing thing that they were able to get so much detail in their fMRI that they could actually tell which person said what by looking at simply at the brain.
And what we're learning by training machines to respond to our voices, like I have in my program and you program you work with, that no wonder our voices are so distinctive, and it will trigger different parts of the brain. But this whole factor of noise, I have to get to. I tell the story, George, this is a story you don't know. I tell the story of once having been in Manhattan. I took a vacation in Hawaii. And I'm in Hawaii, and I'm sleeping outdoors. My friends had a tent outdoors in the middle of Hawaii. And here I am living in New York near a hospital, waiting for the peace and quiet. I get out there, And it was the noisiest thing I ever heard in my life. The animals were screeching and screaming. The birds were making all kinds of sounds. The insects were buzzing all around. And I'm laying there and I'm saying, this is horrible, because my brain wasn't trained for it. My brain didn't hear sirens. If an ambulance came by, I wouldn't hear it. You know, if a fire engine came by, I wouldn't hear it. But I wasn't trained for those birds, and it was the most sleepless night I ever had, and the noisiest.
You know, I think you point to a lot of fascinating subjects when you say that. I mean, first of all, certainly much of our response to noise psychologically is exactly as you say, what we're used to, what we hear day after day. But our bodies always respond in certain ways to loud noises also. And even though you might have found that first night terribly, terribly loud, I suspect that over time you would have gotten used to it, and the damage done by those natural sounds would not be what we experience in the urban environment. For lots of different reasons, it seems that mechanical noise, these manufactured noises that we all are immersed in for most of the time, those of us at least who live in cities, seem to damage us cognitively and cardiovascularly and in our ears in ways that are unfortunately quite serious.
Okay, now this is beginning to sound like the one-liner of noise is bad.
Right. Well,
you know what I mean? And I know you don't want to go there.
And
because it's not what you believe, but it sounds like we're going to be talking about noise pollution, and we're not. It's one aspect.
It's one aspect. And, you know, what I really think of when I think about noise and silence is how, over the course of this journey that I went on over a year, in which I talked to everyone from people who were, from astronauts to monks and people working in neurobiology laboratories, and soldiers as well, I learned again and again that one person's noise is another person's delightful music. And I think a bind, in fact, that we've gotten into as a society when we try to get rid of, quote, noise pollution is we just can't agree on what that is, you know? Many people define noise as unwanted sound. Well, I went and saw that millions of people want the same sounds that millions of others feel tormented by. The same thing happens when you try to think about necessary and unnecessary sound. When I spoke with some people and saw the kinds of noise that they really loved, I thought, like King Lear, reason not the need. I don't think it works that way. But what we may be able to do is, I thought, maybe another way to start thinking about what noise is to think of noise as sound that gets in our heads and we feel we can't get away from it. It could be bad and it could be good, but for the time it's with us, it dominates our perception. It dominates not just maybe our hearing, but our visual experience as well. And what I'd like to see is, rather than endlessly trying to debate, this is too loud, this is not loud enough, maybe we need to think more about how we can get a better balance between sound and something like quiet, so that we open our perceptual modalities, our different ways of taking in the world more porously. We're not as afraid of being assaulted as people often are.
So we have to learn a lot about the nature of sound itself, which we're hoping you teach us today. The nature of sound, this is what you've studied. We hope to be capturing right now the person listening to this show. They're going to hear my voice and your voice, and we hope to be capturing their attention. That's why we're broadcasting. And they're doing it through sound. They're listening to us either in the background or they're listening to us in the foreground, according to their level of interest, according to the way we speak, according to the sound of our voices. Right? I mean, we're doing right in it this minute.
I think that's beautifully put. And I think attention is everything. And what I, rather than, again, thinking about, you know, how are we going to get rid of all those loud noises out there, I think we have to start thinking, what are we going to do to reawaken wonder and attention in the sound of the larger world that people walk through? I think lots of people now, and I want to get into the reasons that this is going on, but lots of people curate their own sound worlds with either a personal sound device or with a television or loud fans and air conditioners. People are trying to create little bubbles that they can exist in and not have to deal with the larger environment. But if we could get everyone really listening to what's out there, I suspect that there would be a deeper concern for the way the world sounds, and people would take measures on their own to make the sound mix that we live in richer, more opulent, the way that many people feel when they get into nature and they are removed from those large pasted on layers of traffic noise and what have you, and suddenly as you began with summer, you know, they're hearing the birds, they're hearing rustling wind, they're hearing those soft sounds that are such a rich mosaic.
You know, I don't know if you've noticed it, audience. He has a beautiful voice. You have a great speaking voice. And I'm not saying this as a compliment. You have a song to your voice that I love. I love hearing the way you talk. I love your choice of words. And I love the timbre of your voice. So I'm imagining as well, I'm saying to myself, boy, you know, he should do recordings about his book. It's really, really good. The quality of the voice, people have told me, the raspiness of my voice captures their attention. It holds them in place as they pass by on the dial. Voices have a quality of capturing people. There must be a different love voice. You know, when you love somebody and you talk to them a certain way. Whereas when you're talking at somebody, you're talking a different way. A business voice must sound very different, must be at a whole other octave to stimulate other parts of the brain. Tell me a little about some of the exciting parts of the research that you've found, some of your fascinating stuff.
Well, I you know, when you say that, I think, first of all, that's another thing that we can delve into endlessly, are the different ways that different voices affect us. And I immediately flash to a famous line, actually, from Hitler, who said, "I could not have conquered Germany without the loudspeaker." And his voice was such a treasured property of the Third Reich, that he actually had a voice double, whose sole purpose was to learn and replicate the cadences with which Hitler's voice became raspy, with which it rose, fell. And it was actually a very modulated voice. People who have studied his speeches talk about the ways that it began in a kind of vicious rasp, and then it would sort of sink into this soft baritone, and then it would start rising up again. And there was something clearly mesmerizing about this. And you can find newspaper articles during the years of Hitler's rise in the 1930s that report in great depth when he began to have some polyps and things on his vocal cords. He had some problems, and this merited a feature article in the New York Times. There really was a sense that his voice was part of what was enabling him to captivate Germany.
Who are some of the great voices that captivated people?
I think voice and charisma are closely linked.
Sure.
And many people now, I think, are finding President Obama's voice. There's a softness. It's got a mellifluous flow to it.
I got to get him on the radio.
Please.
It's a beautiful voice. Sometimes I'm hypnotized. He's just talking and I'm going, oh, he makes sense. And he keeps talking and he keeps on going, and it's beautiful. He doesn't miss his words.
And it's interesting how there are those people who can absorb our attention by becoming louder, and then there are those people who can absorb our attention by becoming softer. And I'm interested in those voices that manage to lower the volume and still be as much of a magnetic force to large numbers of people.
Well, I'm thinking about a baseball game. What was his name, the old baseball, the New York Yankees baseball announcer who's gone? You know, well, he's gone. And how you would pitch that voice up and you'd start screaming and you'd have your audience following with you. So in a way, a broadcaster of a sports game wants you to be playing the game. He wants you to feel it in your body. So he picks up his voice and his cadence so that you're, and now he goes to first base, he's running around to second base, and you're actually in it. You can feel your legs practically.
You can
moving.
Feel yourself accelerating with his words. You can
so
feel
there are different voices for different things. The voice of romance is not the voice of teaching a class unless you want to get in trouble. You know them.
And isn't it true that in therapy, couples therapy, for example, if one of the partners is agitated and the other one is speaking at a very soft, slow pace, that they're not communicating? Isn't it true that they need to meet each other at voice levels and voice intensity in order to communicate and then potentially down-regulate if there's an argument going on?
Well, it's what you're hearing is that they're not connected at all. I don't know if connecting their voices is going to make them connect. But I hear couples when they talk to each other not connecting at all, and you can tell by the voices.
You know, a couple of psychotherapists I spoke with over the course of my research told me that they're increasingly prescribing moments of silence in the course of marital therapy sessions, because they actually find that by not allowing people to speak at all for a few moments, that there can be different kinds of empathy that take place in the exchange that are otherwise just lost in an effort to sort of one-up the other in words and in volume. And
it was in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. In Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the battle was that you have to take a pause. If at any point you feel either one of you are leaving the conversation, you have to take a pause by mentioning something that's like an object or something that you both recognize. And it was Richard Burton, I remember, was delivering the speech about how he would have to freeze himself for a period of time. Because that voice, once you get carried off, sometimes you get lost in your own voice and the energy of your voice and the chemistry of your own agitation.
That's a great word. I mean, I think whenever we think about sound, we have to remember that it's a real physical force. So you can get lost in that energy. And a lot of the sound of the world around us today, however one wants to judge it, is a highly energizing sound. We're looking to get pumped up from noise. We're looking for it in restaurants, or at least we're being subjected to it. We're finding it in retail environments. We're finding it in the sports stadiums is a very concrete example where the noise level is so intense now that in some stadiums people think that there can be damage to our hearing even after a quite short exposure. And certainly the players who play in those environments day after day are in danger of premature hearing loss. But the actual force of that sound going into us stimulates us.
It stimulates us. Now, what does it stimulate? What does it stimulate, Sherry? What's most likely parts, neurochemistry, what's going to get stimulated?
Well, it starts in the outer ear, which is, you can touch your outer ear. It's called the pinna, which amplifies the sound that's coming in, and then reaches into your middle ear, which begins to change the sound, also amplify and change the sound. In the inner ear, it's transduced and then sent to the brain. So the brain perceives the sound in different ways. And although we think about it happening only in our temporal lobe, which is where our hearing brain is, our temporal cortex, it really is interpreted in many parts of the brain. It goes to the sensory part of the brain, so that sometimes we even get goosebumps listening to sounds. It goes to the feeling part of the brain, the limbic system. And so sound is really interpreted in many places. Plus music is interpreted mostly in the right hemisphere, words, conversation, more in the left hemisphere, but it's not exclusive. There are musical parts that are very complex. And
but do you think that there could be a direct, I'm sorry to interrupt, mm-hmm. there's a direct reaction of, for example, cortisol, the neurotransmitters, do you think there could be an immediate reaction to a stimulation of a sound?
You make me think of flight or fright, like we talked about last week. If you hear a very loud sound all of a sudden, it can certainly get your fight or flight reaction going, and your cortisol can increase, your heart rate increases, your blood pressure increases, and you're ready to take off or fight.
You know, and I would just add to that it doesn't have to necessarily be such a loud sound. And although we began talking about the ways that we here in the city are used to those sirens, part of the problem we face is that our bodies don't know from noise. We still respond in our heart rate and in different stress markers as though we have that siren might be for us. And therefore, we're constantly on, I think, a kind of alert somewhere in our systems. You know, our hearing developed to enable us to survive. Our early mammalian ancestors who first crawled out of the water and stepped onto this very hostile environment filled with very large creatures thundering about, they had to move around at night because they were going to get...
Now, wait a minute. When we crawled out onto the water, there was no large creatures thundering.
Not we as in human beings.
No, but we as fish.
When the proto mammals, I'm thinking of something very specific here. The
one with the lungs who crawled up by the fish with a lung-filled fish.
I'm thinking of something called a yanaconodon.
What is yanaconodon? Good.
Yanaconodon.
Is that something like a Jewish? It's a type of food. A Jewish dinosaur.
You know, it's one of the only things you can eat just after Yom Kippur. It was this 5-inch little squirrel-like creature that a fossil of which was discovered just a couple of years ago in these very remote mountains in China. And the remarkable thing about this fossil is it showed a step in the evolution of hearing that had previously been speculated about, but there was no hard evidence for it. Here's the thing: whatever form we had when we were first coming out of the water, we were hearing the world primarily through our skeletons, through our bones. It was bone conduction hearing. The ear was very undeveloped to the extent that there was one at all. And all we felt were these vibrations. And this is still something, I mean, I think of a story told that Edison used to tell. Thomas Alva Edison used to talk about how he would take the wood of his gramophone in his mouth and bite it very hard. He was deaf. And he would talk about when he did this, how he'd get the vibrations of the music good and strong. And he thought he actually heard it better than people who were able to hear through their ears because it wasn't polluted with noise. But in any event, this early form of bone conduction hearing took place in large part in the back of the jaw of some creatures, this Yanaconodon being one of them. And the jaw was really at this point divided into two parts, the front where most of the chewing took place and the back. Well, gradually, as the back of the jaw became less and less concerned with managing to help digestion, it became more and more receptive to sound waves, and it began to shrink. And as it shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, it gradually dislodged itself from the jaw and floated up through the skull into the point in the middle ear where it's lodged today. And the Yanaconodon, you can actually see this bone midway in its grand jeté up into the brain from the jaw. And so I think there's something very suggestive in the idea. I mean, we began talking about the cries of children, the screams of children, and the importance of learning to make that noise. I love that idea that the hearing, that the noise making of the jaw and the hearing of the ear are connected in this very, very primal way.
An easy way. We're speaking with George Prochnik. The name of the book, In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise. Obviously, it's a little noisy out there, friends. Here's a question we have. Does everybody's hearing get worse over time? Do you think just you get older and your hearing gets less? Maybe it's a thinning tympanic membrane? No, they claim. No. Talk about the football field.
Well, there was a fascinating study that was done in the 1960s by a New York audiologist who went off to a remote part of southern Sudan, at that point one of the quietest places on earth. And he visited a tribe known as the Maban people. And he decided to study, he wanted to look at what they heard, this group of people who had not been subject to the sounds of modern civilization. What he found was that the average 70-year-old could hear as well as the average 20-year-old in New York City, and he found that two Maban people standing a football field apart, 100 yards apart, facing opposite directions, could speak in a relatively low voice and hear each other perfectly. So a lot of what we think of as normal age-related hearing loss may, in fact, have something to do with just the stress and wear of being subject to noise day after day.
Or the kind of noise that we get stressed to, that we get listened to.
Good.
You know
point.
What I mean? I mean,
good point.
You're saying the screams of the jungle birds in Hawaii would not damage me as much as the breaks of a siren.
You know,
That's your claim. You say, oh, I'd get used to that eventually because it's natural.
You know, I'd want to do a decibel reading on them before
I pronounce finally
on that. But what I do think is that the certainly when we think about the psychological effects of mechanical noise, there's no question but that these seem to operate on people differently. And there have been recent studies that have looked, for example, at what happens if you're in a relatively loud neighborhood or a little park, say, that's surrounded by traffic on all sides. They've found that if you add on to that layer of infrastructure sound, natural sounds like birds, if you're able to bring in some biodiversity and you have birds and maybe you have a water feature, even though the actual sound level goes up, people perceive that space as being more quiet. An admixture of natural noises seems for some reason to give people something of what we look for when we pursue silence. And I think there's lots of creative possibilities in that sort of experiment that can show us how, even when it's not so easy to get rid of all the cars around us, let alone air traffic, there are ways in which, because so much of our perception of sound is, as Sherry was saying earlier, really is about how it works in the brain, we can take advantage of these in ways that can allow us to give the experience of quiet, if not complete silence more easily than just by reducing noise.
Is there a way for me to get, as a listener, to get a kind of picture of my own soundscape, my own montage? What is my sound to me? How would I be able to figure out what is idiosyncratic? What is special to me? What makes my sound listening different than everybody's?
I'll tell you one very powerful experience that I had. At a certain point, I walked around Columbus Circle, not far from where we are right now, with a peculiar group of meditators who practice this form of spontaneous group meditation in urban environments. And what we did is we walked around in a little group, and then we would drop down into a cross-legged position, close our eyes, meditate for a few minutes, then get up and go to another space. I just wanted to experience what this would be like. But what I found after the second time that we sat down in one part of Columbus Circle was what I was hearing actually to me at that point sounded like the soundtrack of a horror film. I walk through this area almost every day, and I'm reasonably conscious of my sound environment, but I had no idea what it would sound like when I closed my eyes and just stopped moving for a moment. So I think certainly what I would encourage people to do is wherever you are, if you want to start hearing it, one thing you can do is start by shutting out your visual stimulus and stopping moving and start to just count sounds that you have around you, try to discriminate between the different sounds, try to make out all the different sounds, and try to then get an auditory picture of what the sound world in which you're immersed is like. And you'll be amazed, I think, at what you're listening to all the time without really being aware of it.
Great idea. You close your eyes, stand still, open your ears, and listen. Don't do it while you're crossing the street, or the last sound you may hear may be a thump.
I have to say, we had people watching over us as we closed our eyes in the middle of the city. But, you know, on this point, it's interesting that the Latin root of the word silence, desinere, is actually a word meaning stop. And there's another, even older Gothic root, or an old root as well, which means the wind dying down. So the idea of silence, it isn't just auditory quiet, but it's also stopping and being still. And this is rooted in the word itself.
You know, there's a good friend of mine, Dieter Mittelstein Scheid, in Germany, in Italy, who has a farm where he does meditations with people, and he brings couples there and people with many complaints, and what they must do is operate in silence and in slow motion for 2 weeks.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they cook meals together, they do things together, but it's always in silence and it's always in slow motion, because he has slowing down the motion makes a difference too.
I think that's lovely, and I think really part of what we can do if we want more silence in our lives has to do with finding places of stillness. You know, all of these forms of stimulation that we receive come together; they converge. Whether it's all the visual stimulation in a crowded, you know, an environment obviously like Times Square, but even in domestic environments where you have a television on and you have different kinds of moving devices, we need stillness and we need quiet to begin to really take the aural temperature of where we are.
Amazing. This is Armand DeMille with you at the Positive Mind with Sherry Siegel, and we are interviewing George Prochnik, Prochnik, a good book in pursuit of silence, a lot about noise, sound, and it's good learning. I think it's a good thing for a summer read as well. Sorry to reduce it. We're going to be taking a short break. When we come back, we'll continue with more of this. I want to make a mention that yesterday I mentioned an administrative position that I knew of that you could apply for by going to info@thepositivemind.com. We think we filled the position, but do send in any applications because we may have another one opening. So it's info@thepositivemind.com, and that's for an administrative kind of clerical position if anybody's looking. For somebody who's organized and who's comfortable doing that kind of work. So we're going to be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends. When we come back, a little music, and we'll continue in pursuit of silence.
Right here. Music, WBAI, New York.
Tommy, can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me? Can you hear me?
Tommy, can you hear me? Always haunting, right? Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're learning about sound. We're learning about your ears. We're learning about so much. And a writer, George Prochnick, has decided to pursue this and bring us information. Now, part of what he wants is he wants the world to be a little silent, more gentle place, because he believes, and I know he believes it, that if the world was a more gentle place, we'd be a little better off. Have I stretched too far by saying that about you, George?
No, I think that's right. I think, you know, I think one thing we might find is a bit more capacity for empathy, because really, quiet enables us to listen. Quiet for me isn't about trying to go into a chamber, that an absolutely soundproof chamber that allows me to hear nothing but my own heartbeat, as John Cage found. Quiet is about hearing as much as possible, paradoxically. And I think the more that we can listen to each other, the more chance that we'll care for each other. I mean, there's a quote that I love from Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, who talked about how when the Constitution was being written, the framers of the Constitution actually had the road in front of Independence Hall paved with earth to muffle the sound of traffic, because, he said, the democratic process presupposes deliberation, rational deliberation, as a condition of thought and responsible choice on the part of the electorate. And I think if we hear a lot of what's coming out of Washington now, a lot of it is noise. And clearly people don't feel that they can be heard. They feel that just by raising the volume, they can make a point. And to me, this is not what we need from a really fruitful democratic.
You know what it brings to my mind, even though I know you're not a psychologist, George, but I know you're very aware of psychology, clearly. I think about the parent screaming at their child. And I think about a parent deciding to drive a point home by yelling at their children. And you yell at the child, and you yell with such an overpowering voice that the kid's head has to practically split off. It has to kind of leave its body. What do you think the effect of that is on a child, as much as the effect of a truck steaming by in the middle of the night?
Oh, I think it's crushing. I mean, and it reminds me, when you say that, of really why we began making noise to begin with, which, you know, as Darwin says, we began vocalizing in order to fend off rivals in a fight and to court, to seduce mates. We began making noise in situations of maximal aggression. And when we scream at a child, we're putting them in a position they should never be in. This is not about, we don't need to overpower a child with our physical force, the ways that a loud noise can do.
And we do it when we're powerless. You see, when a person feels powerless, that's when they do it to a child. When a child is screaming and they want the child to stop screaming, they scream at the child, stop screaming.
Questions of power get to the roots of noise making. And there was an early 20th century anti-noise activist, someone named Theodor Lessing in Germany, who wanted the world to be quieter. But he didn't just go around telling people, be quiet, tone it down, screaming back at them. He tried to understand what was going on, what was driving people to make noise. And he had this line that stuck with me, where he said that people make noise in order to magnify their sphere of power. And he used the example of a coachman cracking his whip, or a maid dragging out the bedding and shaking it on the line, or a drummer beating a drum. He said that noise is a way of expanding the territory we can dominate. And certainly when I think about some of the forms of noise which bother a lot of people today, whether it's boom cars or
motorcycles,
you know, what we're seeing is some sort of effort to create greater real estate domination through sound.
Interesting that drumming has become so popular among the youth recently, because drumming is an acceptable way of raising a racket. You know what I mean? You can make all the noise you want, and your parents don't think you're really hostile, they're really mad at me. You're just playing an instrument.
And you're releasing some of that excess.
And you're showing me your need for power at the same time. You moved around. You were a kid. You moved around a lot. And you have one fascinating part that gets me, being in Israel and being aware of sound. I can't imagine any place in the world that would be more fascinating for listening than Israel itself.
Could you
talk a little about it? It's almost mind-bending.
It's acoustically unbelievably rich. You're right, and partly because it seems to me that the sound landscape, what people call the soundscape of Jerusalem and Israel in general, goes through many, many different historical layers. You know, you have the biblical sounds of people still tending their flocks of goats right in the middle of the city, in these valleys that surround the old walls of the city. You have women, old women visible up in the olive trees shaking the branches, and you hear that sound of the olives coming off the ends of the branches and falling into baskets. And then you also, though, along with these sounds and the sounds of bells and the sounds of muezzins and the sounds of all the different faiths calling their flocks to worship, you also have these very interesting 21st century layers of sound. I mean, you have both the sounds we know very well, like traffic, but you also have all sorts of experimental music and things going on, and you have all the sounds of cafe life and retail life and commercial.
And military rattling, too.
And military life as well. So you get this unbelievably complex complex weave of different time periods and different noise sources. But, you know, one of the things that really overwhelmed me when I was in Israel was the first time that I heard the 2 minutes of silence that is part of the commemoration of Holocaust Day. This was not something that I had thought about beforehand. I didn't imagine it being particularly affecting to me. I didn't go outside to hear that silence. But when I was walking down the street and the siren went off announcing it, and then all motion stopped, all the cars stopped, people step out of their cars and stand beside it, and you watch the traffic lights flickering with no motion at all, I felt that silence, it was as though it carved a hole in the middle of the present and allowed this extraordinary, terrible past to just come flooding through. I really felt something much, much more powerful than I could have dreamed of. The whole story with moments of silence is kind of interesting, because we think that the first national moment of silence was the national moment of silence commemorated in England for Armistice Day. And it proved so effective that the BBC actually began broadcasting the moments of silence, and they did this for decades. And I was curious about why this was found to be so popular as it was, and there was a very interesting set of remarks made by a BBC commentator in the 1930s who said that, of course, what you're hearing in that moment of silence again is not silence. You're hearing birdsong, and you're hearing the sound of leaves rustling. And in some way, this silence, he says, dissolves individual personality and gives us leave to be great and universal. There's a sense of solidarity in silence, which is clearly why there's so many moments of silence to mark national tragedies to this day. It does something to the individual ego and makes us identify with people around us and also with the larger world, so that we're hearing with a crispness the acoustical detail of where we are.
So you were always aware as a child, were you always aware of sound?
I think I was always reasonably aware.
But more conscious than most about how sounds would be irritating or hurt or more sensitive to?
I think actually I craved sound as a child, you know. I craved and I wanted again rich sound. I wanted lots of sounds. And I think that part of
it. Was there an absence of sound? Because you moved around a lot. Your father was a diplomat, right?
Well, actually, yeah, he was a diplomat, and I loved the different sounds of different environments we spent time in. I mean, we lived for a number of years in Santiago, and that had its own strange mixture of neighborhoods that could be very quiet, and then these unbelievably robust and wonderfully loud markets with vendors calling out their wares like they would have done in the Lower East Side 100 years ago.
But as the child of a diplomat, might you not have been protected from the environments, like kind of isolated away, so that you didn't get in touch with it?
That's a good point. I think that my parents made some effort to overcome that and really took me out to lots of different places where we traveled to. But certainly there's that danger that if you're coming at it from top down, you're not necessarily going to be exposed to what it is to be living in, say, next to a market or something like that.
Have you been on any of the trips to Africa where you've been getting a chance to really hear and see the animals in the wild?
I have to say, I have not been to Africa.
Have you spoken to people who have?
I have, and they talk about being overwhelmed.
Overwhelmed by this sound. that they say they know is them. I know this is in my history. My friend Ricky was telling me, she was recently on a safari, and she said, I know this sound is part of my heredity. I know it's there. I know this very sound that I was listening to was part of what I was born with.
I think it's an amazing idea to be able to get in touch with that. And, you know, it actually makes me think of a story that was told me by a guy who was a special operations soldier in Afghanistan and in Iraq. He's since gone on to become a philosophy student in Columbia. So he's a complex person. But he described for me how central the role of silence was in operations. And not only in terms of needing to hear every single sound in the environment, because it could mean the difference between life and death, and that sort of charged awareness, which maybe also speaking to your friend's experience, we can think about identifying with sounds in the plains of Africa. We can also think about identifying with the silences. But he also talked about what happened in battle with sound and with silence, and it was intriguing.
Well, tell me a little more about it. What happened in battle with sound and silence?
Well, what he said was that when you got into a gunfight, predictably, the first 2 or 3 seconds were unbelievably loud, the loudest thing you could imagine. But then suddenly, all the sound cut out, he said, through some combination of temporary hearing damage and something psychological. He said it became absolutely silent, and he was just cued into the muzzle flashes at the end of guns. And he said it was actually a completely zen state. He said that the silence enabled him to concentrate and be absolutely in the moment in a way that it would have been impossible if he was actually hearing all these very, very loud weapons going on around him. I mean, we think about the beginning of Private Ryan, and there's that moment where the sound whooshes out of the scene. And he said that's actually what happened to him every time.
Wow, fascinating. Tell me about the rats.
I know about a couple of sets of rats in here.
Yeah, now that people know that we're nice, and that if we talk about rats, we're not doing it to gross you out. But even though a lot of people get really, they feel affected by the sound of the word. But what about the rat experiment?
Well, let's think about rats and stimulation.
Sure.
To go back to these questions we had at the beginning, and one of the proofs that we had that noise is a real stimulant can be found in a study that was done a couple of years ago by Italian researchers, who administered low doses of ecstasy to 2 groups of rats. One of these groups of rats was in a laboratory setting, very quiet, and the other group was in a setting with a sound level typical for a discotheque. What they found was that the rats who were given the drug in quiet, their brains straightened out in less than 24 hours. The rats who were given it in the loud environment, it took more than 5 days for their electrocortical parameters to straighten out again. So clearly, the noise actually increased the toxicity of the drug. But
Wait a minute. Toxicity became a funny word. You mean increase the effect of the drug?
Well, I think I use the word toxicity because, in fact, their brains were tangled up. They were incapable of firing correctly.
But maybe the idea of taking ecstasy is to tangle up your brain. You know what I mean? I mean, maybe the object was tangle up my brain so that it's not going the straight direction, most people. So what it does is what it does, but it had a longer lasting effect.
Certainly, you're getting more of the drug.
That's getting
you're more bang for the buck if you want to look at it positively, but you're getting more effect. And this comes back, I mean, maybe really to the larger questions about what the nature of the stimulation of sound is. I mean, one more rat study I have to tell you about, which I don't know what to make of. This was done in the 1950s in Japan, where a group of scientists took a group of rats and raised them in the quiet laboratory setting, one group, and a second group they raised under an elevated train where there were more than 1,200 passages a day. So they had all sorts of predictions about what these rats raised in noise would be like. They thought they'd be a nervous wreck. In fact, they were a nervous wreck. They had, not only were they more aggressive and more confused, but they had lower fertility rates and bad eating habits. But the twist was that the rats raised in noise also lived 53 days longer than the rats raised in quiet.
Mm.
They repeated the experiment. They raised a group of rats in the main floor of a Tokyo Daily. And again in the laboratory, it happened again. They did it a third time. Each time, the rats raised a noise lived much longer. So what was being stimulated there? I don't know. I put the question to you, but clearly there was some sort of real energy that may have made their lives not worth living, but they were certainly had much, much more longevity.
What do you think, Sherry? You think it's just that stress in some way strengthens us for a longer lasting, you know, could be.
It's hard to predict. It's hard to know about that. But maybe the hormones that that do pump us up and get us moving, going, thinking, hypervigilant, maybe they do have an influence on our survival.
I wonder, what's the life expectancy of the average Buddhist? Can we compare that to...
Well, it made me also wonder if the rats were lower in weight. Apparently, a lower calorie intake can also prolong life, apparently.
That's a good thought. So the fact that they couldn't eat because they were anxious all the time.
Well, that was something that Lauren had as a question. Lauren, you had a question about the diet thing.
Oh, yes. There's a comparison that when you receive noise, it's almost as similar to when you're eating and digesting. So I was curious as to, I guess, to touch on also what Dr. Siegel had said about, you know, too much carbs and not enough protein. So what would you consider, I guess, the negative sound or the toxic sound, and how could we kind of fine-tune that to where we're only, you know, digesting what's necessary or beneficial?
Well, I don't think we can just digest what's necessary, but I really came to feel that diet, thinking about a sound diet, was one way that we might be able to get around the whole way of worrying about what is noise pollution and what is not. Maybe rather than thinking about noise in terms of as a pollutant, which I think very loud forms of noise are, you know, a very loud jet, naval sonar, which is doing terrible, terrible things to marine mammals. These are clearly pollutants. But most of the noise that aggravates most people isn't one of those giant noise sources. So I think what we have to do is think about creating a more balanced diet between sound and silence. It's not that I think so much X noise is going to be the nurturing one, as that we need to break up the constant ingestion of sound and of sonic junk from, say, certain malls or from certain restaurants with other kinds of sound that are more nuanced. Okay. And so, you know, during the course of this year where I traveled around, what I was most disturbed by was feeling that there are so many people now, particularly people living in underserviced communities, who just have no experience of silence at all in their lives. You know, they go from loud homes to loud streets to loud places of work.
And then they go home, leave their TV on, and fall asleep to the TV with commercials in the middle of the TV, and the TV becomes... They wonder, without a sound, I feel lonely. Can we talk about that?
Well, there's a lot to say about how sound fills these gaps of fear, really, maybe ultimately fear of death. And of course, silence, absolute silence, is the end of all vibration. I mean, it is death. We're not pursuing that very many
times. Well, how do we know that?
Because
how do we know that death is the absence of sound? It might be the noisiest time we could imagine.
In a physical sense, if we are no longer moving in any way, just mm-hmm. I'm talking on a very simple bodily way. If our body has ceased moving, it's ceased vibrating, and we're living. And if you're in the depths of outer space, of course there are these loud events of supernovas or what have you. Mm-hmm. But in terms of our the world that we inhabit, I think we inhabit a world of vibrations. That's how we communicate with each other. That's whether through touch or through voice. And vibrations, in some way, we all crave and need. But you know, I remember being really struck by a conversation that I had with a teacher in a tough neighborhood here in New York City, who told me that he couldn't get his kids to be quiet for 1 minute. And I just found it hard to believe. He's a guy, he's 6'4", an athlete, very commanding, authoritative figure. I just didn't think this could be true. And I went to the school, and I saw that he couldn't do it. I went back to the school. I went back several times. They were incapable of understanding the idea. And I then went home, and I said to this guy, all right, I want you to ask these students to remember one powerful moment of silence in your life. And I would then like to come into the school and listen to them and hear what this was. And I was very eager to hear what these kids who come from these loud and often disrupted homes had to say was at least one moment. So I sat down with 10 students. Every single one of these students, without exception, told me a story such as, I remember the time that my father hit my mother. I didn't want to speak with anyone for a week. I remember after my brother was killed in a gang fight, I couldn't talk. I remember when I was beaten up, I didn't want to speak with anyone. In every case, it was a sense of being silenced by an anguished experience. And I just thought, this is wrong. These kids have got to be given a positive experience of silence. I mean, how can we tell someone to be quiet, to shut up, who doesn't really know what silence is?
Oh, how beautiful. I'll tell you an experiment my friend Cherry Quincy did out in California. She had a thing called a galvanic skin response machine. And, oh no, it was right here in New York, actually. It's a guy had this GSR machine that you put on your fingers, and by putting it on your fingers, you can make a sound, and it will lower the sound as you relax your brain. So it was just plain GSR. He took this into a prison, and he gave it to prisoners, and he told the prisoners, if you want more power to your punch, right, and these are guys who were working out in the gym, you do this machine, and the one who could get the sound the lowest will have more power. So he got them to compete in being silent.
That's
and it was brilliant.
That's a beautiful story. And you know what it makes me think of is Senreikyu, the great 17th century Japanese tea master, who actually managed to seduce the samurai into being quiet in a similar competitive way. He's the one who really created this tea ceremony, which is
where it came from. Good.
He made this tea ceremony, which is done in complete silence, but which is all about listening to these small sounds, the sound of a wooden ladle cracking on the teacup, the sound of the kimonos slithering over these mats, the different sounds of wind and birds outside. And he made it a kind of competition into how much you could hear, how much you could get from this theater. And in fact, the samurais had to put down their swords. They didn't fit through the doors to get into the tea ceremony. And for a time, he really did manage, like your friend, to seduce even this very, very loud demographic, as loud as anything we've got today, that's for sure, into feeling that there could be another kind of strength that was worth exploring, the strength about proving how much you could absorb from the world around you, and how much this could expand your own self.
George, it's beautiful work. Sherry Siegel, I want to thank you very much for your work on this. George Prochnik, In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise. Special thanks for being with us, George. I want to get back to you and talk about the other book that you did when we get another time.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Sure. And remember, my friends, administrative, possible clerical position, probably filled already, but if you want to send out a resume, it's info@thepositivemind.com. We're going to be going for now. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. Go to our website, thepositivemind.com, and pick up more and more information.
Controversial Ending the Slavery Blame Game article, which he suggests that Africans are are as much to blame for the Holocaust of enslavement as Europeans.